The Jodcast. Because we're worth it. From the National Astronomy Meeting, Day 3.
Okay, hello and welcome to Day 3 of NAM, the National Astronomy Meeting in Preston. We've lost Nick, but we've gained some other people. Now, one of the people we've got with us is a familiar on the Jodcast, Megan Argo.
Hello.
And we've also got someone who we've interviewed in the past on the Jodcast, David Boyce.
Hello.
He's from the University of Leicester. And we also have Paul Steele, who's an infrared astronomer from the University of Leicester as well.
Yes, hello.
Okay, so you've all been here today. You've all been to lots of sessions.
A whole two, yes.
A whole two. So what did you go to, Paul?
This morning we went to the Young Astronomers Meeting, YAM at NAM, and then this afternoon the Degenerate Astronomy,
the
White Dwarf
Degenerate
Pulsars.
Degenerate Astronomy?
Yes, White Dwarfs, Pulsars and Brown Dwarfs.
Right, okay, David, tell us what happened at the Young Astronomy Meeting.
Well, the Young Astronomy Meeting was a fantastic way for young people to engage with young people in astronomy. We listened to three very good talks in the morning. In the afternoon it was cosmology, so I didn't really go to that. But in the morning, it was Mark Swinbank from the University of Durham, and he was talking about red-shifted hydrogen Lyman line in distant galaxies. And his basic idea was that the only explanation for these red-shifted material was that there was a shell existing around certain galaxies. And this was very fascinating because I hadn't heard of this previous up to this stage, so that was a very interesting talk to go to. We also had Chris Lintott. You may know Chris Lintott from BBC's Sky at Night programme. And he was doing a talk based on, is it astrochemistry?
Astrochemistry.
And he was looking at dust grains and the different molecules that are apparent in the interstellar medium. And that was a very interesting talk as well, because that's quite far removed from what I do. But it was useful because studying a different sort of field, it was useful to get an insight into a field that I didn't have a lot of experience in. And finally, we had Lucy Hadfield from the University of Sheffield, who was doing a talk in Wolf-Rayet stars and the sort of situations that we find them in.
What are Wolf-Rayet stars, then?
Well, Wolf-Rayet stars, they're the heaviest stars that you can get, basically. They're the most supermassive, super bright, super hot. But because they are so big, they're described as the James Dean of the star world. They live fast and die young. And the point is that these stars are very rare because they normally get to the end of their lives in such a short time scale that we don't observe them. And the point was that she was observing them in other galaxies and she was finding many of them using different images of different wavelengths. So that was a very interesting talk as well. Now, the Young Astronomers Meeting is an opportunity for people just starting out in their astronomy careers to talk to other people and get experience in presentation skills and such like.
Okay, now earlier on I caught up with Stuart Ayres of the University of Central Lancashire. He's on the organising committee for the National Astronomy Meeting. Can you tell us a little bit about NAM?
Well, the National Astronomy Meeting is a big meeting of astronomers from the United Kingdom, sponsored by the Royal Astronomical Society. Usually around 300 to 400 of us get together every year to discuss a whole range of astronomy. This year we're also being joined unusually by the UK solar physics people, and for the first time, the solar terrestrial people. So we're actually up to 520 people this year.
That's an awful lot of people.
I think it makes us the biggest NAM ever, yes.
It must be a logistical nightmare for you.
Not quite a nightmare, but certainly requires a lot of detailed planning and solving of problems that crop up as you go along, problems with accommodation, transport and so on.
So when did you start planning for NAM?
Well, there's a little story behind that. Originally, this NAM was intended to be at Amsterdam, and for some reason that fell through. So
that's the UK National Astronomy Meeting in Amsterdam?
In Amsterdam. And about 12 months ago, it fell through, and I had an email from our head of centre, Gordon Bromwich, saying, do we fancy hosting NAM? Well, I've just said we will. So that was it then. From there, it's all sort of systems go. We got things set up, running websites and organising science sessions and so on. So Brad Gibson's organised all the science sessions, organised the conveners to organise the science sessions, and I've been organising a lot of the other things. Robert Walsh has been working on the UK solar physics and solar terrestrial stuff. Running up to it, and particularly last week and the week before, all those things that you think, right, if I just spend 10 minutes now or an hour now, I can get that sorted out and it won't be a problem in the week. And so the whole week was a sort of that level of stress of, got to get this sorted out now because I know. And now there's things I just can't do and you just have to live with them. And there's other things that are working really well. And now I'm just enjoying the buzz of the place, having all these people here. You know, I actually enjoy helping people out. You know, where do I find the press room, or where do I find this session, or how do I get to the conference dinner and so on. And just the buzz of having people here and enjoying it and taking in some of the science sessions. On the Monday, I didn't end up in getting into any of the science sessions, but since then I managed to get into some and really enjoying those science sessions. And bizarre experience, despite the fact I was involved in gathering all the abstracts, it was only when we came to put the abstract book together and I was actually glancing through them, I was thinking, oh, not seen that, that's interesting. No, oh, I'd like to go to that one as well, you know. And you suddenly realise how the breadth and the depth of what we're doing here.
And there was a live webcast, I think, the other day.
Yes, that's right. Monday we had a live webcast of our Astronomy Question Time, so that involved Chris Lintott of Sky at Night fame as the chair, and Jocelyn Bell-Bunnell, of course, is the discoverer of pulsars, our very own Don Kurtz, who's an astroseismology expert, and Lucy Green from MSSL, who sort of filled in on the sort of solar physics side.
Is there any plan to make that webcast an archive, put it in an archive?
I believe it is archived, yes. I'm supposed to be putting that on our website soon, so I'll try and do that.
Right. So when you do, we'll put a link to it on our show notes.
That's brilliant.
And so people who missed it the first time because it was live, and so yes, some people in different parts of the world won't be able to
watch
it.
That's right.
It's been an excellent conference so far.
Good. Glad you enjoyed it.
Yep. And we've got a few more days left, so we'll try and cover it on the Jodcast as much as we can. Thank you for talking to us.
No problem. No, thanks for asking me.
That was Stuart Ayres of the University of Central Lancashire.
During the middle sessions of Wednesday, I sat in on the current facilities, as many of you did as well,
yeah.
And there were some very interesting talks about the telescopes and facilities that are in use at the moment. Now, I know that Ian Steele spoke about the Liverpool Robotic Telescope on the Rocca della Muchachos Observatory in La Palma, and he was talking about future developments.
They've got a few instruments on there already, and the telescope's been going for some time now. One of the instruments is called Frodo Speck, which obviously takes its name from Lord of the Rings. One of the other instruments is the Ringo instrument, which is a polarimeter, so it looks at the polarisation of the light, like when you use a pair of polarised sunglasses. But this looks at the polarisation of the starlight, basically by spinning around very, very quickly. And it makes the stars track out a circle on the camera. You can look at the way that the brightness of the star changes as it goes around this circle, and that tells you about the polarisation of the star. So he was talking about those instruments and telling us about the current performance of the Liverpool telescope, the downtime due to problems, because it's all robotically controlled. So a computer makes decisions what to observe during the night. Everyone goes to sleep. So I think the downtime was down to 9% now.
9% this year so far, yeah. Which is
an
improvement on previous years by quite a long way, yeah.
What caught your interest, David?
I thought one of the most interesting talks at the current facilities session at the NAM was a talk by Rennie Ritten on the future of the WHT, the William Herschel Telescope in La Palma. Now, the background behind this is that Britain has paid into the WHT and the Isaac Newton group of telescopes for a long time, and our astronomers have been given a section of the time and have been able to observe with these.
The other people who are involved in that are the Netherlands and Spain, I think, aren't they?
That is. We have a slightly more than one-third share at the moment. However, due to the rearrangement of the research councils that fund us as PhD students and fund astronomy, there has been a reprioritisation of where money should go. And therefore, they feel that we should be putting less money into these telescopes, the repercussions of which are that we are not going to be able to have as much time. Our 50% share in the time of this telescope is going to down to 25%. Now, this is a travesty for UK astronomy because the WHT is one of the major installations that we go out to, especially in the optical wavelengths. And the situation is more dire than that because the WHT and the Isaac Newton group of telescopes, it's a group of telescopes. And though the WHT is very oversubscribed in observation, the Isaac Newton telescope, a slightly smaller one, is the sort of workhorse of UK astronomy. Now, they're threatening that if we can't fund it, that they may have to shut this telescope down and no one would be able to use it because they can't afford it.
And that's likely to be in 2009 if it happens.
If it happens, it could be by 2009.
It sounds as though you should set up a campaign to save the WHT.
Which is starting
now. You seem
to
be getting quite passionate about this.
Which is starting now. The WHT will survive because it's still a world-class facility. But the Isaac Newton telescope, it could get chopped off.
Was Isaac Newton based at Greenwich at one point?
The Isaac Newton telescope, the telescope itself, was actually in Hermosillo.
Oh, of course.
And then they took it to bits. and then sent it to La Palma and reconstructed it there. And so it's been working there ever since. So it's a very old telescope, but still able to produce fantastic results. So under no consequences should we allow this telescope to be decommissioned.
OK, so Megan, you actually gave part of a talk at the current facilities session, didn't you?
Yes, I gave part of the talk on the upgrade to the Merlin telescope, which will be called eMerlin. So Merlin is the network of telescopes that we operate at Jodrell. So we've got the Lovell telescope, we've got several other telescopes around the country as well, and we link them all together to pretend that we have a bigger telescope. So it's called Aperture Synthesis.
Right, and so it gives you a telescope how big?
Merlin is 217 kilometres in diameter.
So a radio telescope 217 kilometres across?
Effectively, yes. It means that basically the bigger your telescope, the better your resolution, the more detail you can see. And because radio wavelengths are so long, to get the same resolution, to see the same amount of detail with a radio telescope as you see with something like the Hubble Space Telescope, you'd need to build a radio telescope that was 200 kilometres in diameter. So Merlin gets the same resolution at radio wavelengths as the Hubble Space Telescope, 2.4 metres in diameter, does in optical wavelengths.
OK, so what's the difference between Merlin and eMerlin? What's the E for?
The E is, I think, short for enhanced. It's basically a big upgrade where we're replacing the current links, which are microwave links between the telescopes, which transmit the data collected by each telescope back to Jodrell Bank to be put together in a computer called a correlator. And we're replacing those with fibre optic links, basically using the internet to transfer the data, which will mean we've got a much bigger bandwidth. We can send more data back, and the more data you can send back, the more sensitive your images are going to be. So the further away we can see in the universe, the fainter objects we can pick out.
OK, now, earlier, David, you caught up with Monica Grady of the Open University in one of the poster sessions. Let's find out what she had to say.
OK, this is David Boyce reporting for the Jodcast. I'm now talking to Monica Grady at NAMM 2007. So exactly why are you here? Are you presenting anything?
Hi, David. No, I'm not presenting anything here at NAMM. I've just come to listen and learn and find out what's hot in the different fields.
You've just told me that in astrobiology there's an interesting summer school that's being arranged. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's right. Each year, PPARC as was, but the Science and Technologies Facility Council as is now, they organise summer schools for new PhD students for two reasons. One, so that the new students can get to know each other from all over Britain, so that they can come together to form their new community. And two, so that they can learn what's state of the art in the broader field. And this year, for the first time, there's going to be a summer school in astrobiology. And this is going to, we hope, draw between 20 and 30 new PhD students who are studying physics, astronomy, biology, chemistry, planetary sciences, bring them all together so they can find out about different aspects of astrobiology, because it's a really broad field.
I know that you were heavily involved with ALH 84001, the meteorite from Mars. I wonder if you can tell me that at the time it was suggested that a small shape in the rock was potentially a fossil of a segmented worm. I wonder if you can tell me what's the latest on that.
Right, well, this work was, 11 years ago now, so it was in 1996, amazingly enough, and some scientists from NASA found this little structure. And since then, there's been a lot of work done on the structure, on the meteorite, rather. The general feeling is that it probably wasn't a Martian fossil. If it was any sort of fossil, it was a terrestrial contaminant. But it's more likely that it wasn't a fossil at all, that it was just actually a way the rock had broken. And what it illustrated was that you can't just rely on images alone. You've got to have chemical, isotopic data to help reinforce, because shape is subject to all sorts of different interpretations. What it did do, though, was it really pushed forward Martian exploration and the idea of looking for extremophiles, so microorganisms that live in extreme habitats, looking for those on Mars. So it was a great thing for science, even though it didn't actually turn out to be the first indication of Martian life.
They often refer to meteorites as being the poor man's spacecraft that
A lot of things can be studied when the rocks come to us rather than going elsewhere to study. I wonder, do you think that spacecraft are now the future of astrobiology, or do you still think that meteorites are potentially a good source of information?
Well, given that I make my living studying meteorites, I don't think I'm going to say that that can all be replaced by spacecraft. Definitely not. No, seriously, we can learn so much from meteorites. They fall on the Earth all the time, and they carry within them records of all epochs of solar system history. So you get meteorites that have never been heated, which are the unaltered material that the solar system is made from, and that's the only physical stuff that we can analyse. But buried within those are grains that have come from beyond the solar system. So there's a whole host of grains that were formed before the solar system was formed, grains that have come from red giant stars, from supernovae, and so from other stellar bodies. And they tell us the history of the fragment of molecular cloud that collapsed to form our own solar system. And again, this is the only physical material that we can look at. There is organic stuff there, which is remnants of the molecules from the interstellar medium that undergo ion molecule reactions, so polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, stuff like that. And the building blocks of life, they're all in there. So there's an enormous amount of information we get from meteorites, not just about our solar system, but about our galaxy as well. So it'll be a long, long time before studying meteorites is replaced by spacecraft. So I regard myself as a laboratory-based astronomer. I do my astronomy down the microscope rather than using a telescope.
What do you think about the possibility of life on Europa?
Oh, now, Europa is a really fascinating body. And the problem with Europa is it's so far away and it's going to be so expensive to get there, even with the European Space Agency's new call for missions, where one of the favourite missions is one to go to Europa. One of the fascinating things about Europa is the parallels that there are between Europa and the subglacial lakes in Antarctica. So Antarctica's covered by ice, and below that ice there are many, many lakes which contain microorganisms which have been isolated there for hundreds of thousands of years, and it's possible that a similar sort of organisms might survive below the ice on Europa. It's going to be a real challenge to determine how we can get through many kilometres of ice though on Europa.
What's the cutting edge at the moment? What are you working on right now?
Right. Cutting edge research. Now, my problem is that I've got my fingers in so many pies. I'm doing so many different things. Yeah, I get to committee meetings, write grant proposals, get my grant proposals rejected, etc., etc. But I've got a student at the moment who's working on ultraviolet spectroscopy, and we've got a really neat machine, a really neat telescope, which can measure the spectra of solids and liquids from about 190 nanometers up to about 800 nanometers. So it's not the VUV, but it's UV up to and through the visible. And we're using that to look at a whole range of minerals and ices and minerals in ices, so that we can look at the ultraviolet spectra of asteroids, Kuiper Belt objects, Europa, various other things, to find out what sort of materials are in those objects. There has been quite a lot of UV spectroscopy done by telescope, you know, IUE, FUSE, things like that, but there are very few lab databases. And so we're actually doing a lab database so we can match our work with asteroids and see what space weathering does to asteroids, look at debris disks around stars, all sorts of things, because organics have very distinctive UV signatures. So that's the work I'm doing at the moment.
In the field of astrobiology, what are the big questions that you predict will be solved in the next 10 years?
Oh, crikey, in the next 10 years. Well, I really hope in the next 10 years we'll know a lot more about Mars and about what's on the surface of Mars and what's just below the surface. I think Mars is going to be where it's at for the next few years, but after that, Europa, I think, is going to have to be our focus.
Mm-hmm. Monica Grady, thank you very much.
OK, Paul, you are resident degenerate expert. Tell us what happened at the degenerate astronomy session.
Well, we had seven talks today, so it would take some time to go through all of them. But the most interesting ones I found, anyway, was the first one we had by Ben Burningham from Hertfordshire. He talked about brown dwarfs in the UKIDS Large Area Survey.
So what is UKIDS?
UKIDS is the UK Infrared Deep Sky Survey. So what Ben Burningham was looking for was essentially the coolest brown dwarfs.
So brown dwarfs are like failed stars?
Essentially just failed stars. And getting cooler, you're also getting towards, say, Jupiter-type planets or Saturn and getting towards that kind of low-mass area. Essentially, what he's doing is he's looking at the spectra of these late-type brown dwarfs. The sequence goes currently from late M is the classification of the first brown dwarf, through L's, through the T's, and currently the latest one they have is T8.5, maybe T7.5.
And where do these mythical Y dwarfs come into all this?
The Y dwarfs will come into it where they basically haven't decided yet. Essentially, the spectra will change in some incredibly odd way where they will decide that's a Y naught and then go from Y naught, Y1, Y2 as this really odd change gets bigger.
So they haven't found any Y dwarfs yet?
No.
But they've already classified them?
But they have already classified them. It's a letter someone came up with in a paper some time ago that's just been adopted.
Okay.
Go on then, David, you've got something to say.
In the plenary session this morning, they were talking about the archaeology of Andromeda. Now, this isn't...
So what do they mean by archaeology?
This is the sort of the history of that the galaxy has gone through. It's sort of like what has happened in the past to this galaxy. Now, we see a snapshot of time, and by looking at how the star streams are and the various things attached to Andromeda, we can see what's happened recently. Now, what they've detected is a very large star stream, like another dwarf galaxy of some sort has cruised through, torn out a region of stars, and those stars are left behind, and these are what's being detected. Now, I find it very amazing, actually, that at the end of this star stream is M33. But
it seems to be pointing in that direction, doesn't it, on the pictures that they were showing?
Very much, and the width of the star stream seems to indicate that a very large object has passed through, not a dwarf galaxy. However, I've been reliably told that M33 is not the object that passed through Andromeda, that it's an object that we have not detected yet. So, at this point in time...
It's not passed through Andromeda. If it had passed through Andromeda, Andromeda would be a major starburst, and it's not.
So therefore, it's not.
Well, it's not passed through Andromeda, but it could have passed close by.
It's passed close by, and the tidal interaction will have distorted it, but it's not.
Exactly, that's what I meant.
I think I'm being pedantic. Say that it wasn't quite angled towards M33.
It wasn't quite exactly on the angle that it needed to be. Of course, one of the major events that I'm personally looking forward to with Andromeda is the fact that Andromeda is moving towards the Milky Way.
That's an incredible speed. We have a collision with it in 3 billion years' time, I think.
Exactly. I will be there with my
hot dog. Frozen.
Yes. I would like to be thawed for that event. Yesterday, I managed to present my own results looking at white dwarfs and UV spectra. And through these results, I managed to find something very interesting about the local environment around our sun. The local bubble that people have been talking about for years is a supernova remnant. A supernova went off quite close to the sun sometime in the past, and it cleared out all of the gas in the local area.
And was that before or after the sun formed?
It was probably after, because the sun's been around for at least, 5 billion years? And
so you're saying at some point the solar system had all this material pushed through it?
Well, the magnetic influence of the sun, the magnetosphere, keeps most of the interstellar medium in the interstellar regions. Mm. We live in a protected zone that is put up to us by the sun, and the Voyager spacecraft are just leaving this zone as we speak.
Actually, that's quite appropriate that you should mention this about the heliosphere, because I talked to Dr. Lucy Green, who's one of the organisers for the International Heliophysical Year in the UK, and this is what she had to say.
International Heliophysical Year is many things, actually. The first thing, which is rather nice, is celebrating 50 years of space science. 50 years ago in 1957, we had an event called International Geophysical Year, and it was a time when scientists around the world came together to answer fundamental science questions about the Earth, and the Earth's oceans and the Earth's atmospheres. Atmosphere. And it involved apparently around 60,000 scientists.
60,000, that's an awful lot of scientists.
Yeah, it was a huge, huge project. I mean, the legacy lives on today in that it was the international collaborations started to grow. So to answer these big science questions, you needed lots of scientists focused on them. And so you needed lots of people working together. And the other thing that you needed were instruments flying in space. Mm. So in 1957, we saw the launch of the first artificial satellites and the
Sputnik.
Course, Sputnik. Yeah, Sputnik 1. So very, very famous event. And in International Heliophysical Year, we're studying or celebrating, 50 years since that really momentous event. Now, the other aspect of Heliophysical Year is the science side of it and what we're actually doing in this time. And we're looking beyond the Earth now. And actually, the new frontier for International Heliophysical Year is actually at the edge of the solar system. So we're interested in the centre of the solar system, the sun, going all the way out, following right to the edge of the sun's sphere of influence, which is called, well, the heliosphere is the name for the region of the solar system that the sun influences. Basically, it has all the planets in it, and it goes out, and then we have the edge of our heliosphere, and the other side of that is the interstellar space. So International Heliophysical Year is about studying processes that happen within the sun's magnetic realm of influence.
Okay, so how big is this heliosphere?
It's rather large. So we think from the sun out to the edge of the heliosphere is about 12 billion kilometres.
That's a very long way.
Huge distances. But then, incredibly, when you think about the spacecraft that were launched in the 1970s, Voyager 1 is thought to be almost out at that distance and is, in fact, reaching the edge of our own solar system, which is quite mind-boggling. So these satellites that were launched, these spacecraft that were launched, have been like ghost ships over the last few years. But every now and then we get a signal back from them telling us what the conditions are like and teaching us about the edge of our own solar system.
So scientifically, what type of experiments will be happening this year?
Well, there's lots of things happening. But one thing to say is that International Heliophysical Year isn't a pot of money to fund new missions. Mm. It's about focusing people's minds and making the most of what we have already, actually. And in the UK, one area of focus is looking at how the sun affects the Earth and looking at the fact or having the view that the sun and the Earth are connected, and that the Earth is really sitting in the outer part of the sun's atmosphere. So we're in this very complex and dynamic environment. And we have about 12 space missions, actually, which are looking at this sun-Earth connection. So it shows the importance of the science, really.
So we've got 12 missions looking at the sun?
Yes, looking at the sun or looking at how the sun affects the Earth. So they range from missions that are actually a million miles away from upstream of the Earth towards the sun. And there's a spacecraft there called SOHO. There's other spacecraft there as well. And they look at the sun and they sense emissions coming off of the sun on their way to the Earth. And then we have spacecraft orbiting around the Earth, again looking at the sun or sensing how the Earth's magnetic field changes in response to emissions from the sun. So one thing to mention is that the sun produces the biggest explosions and eruptions in the solar system, and they can have a big impact on the Earth, and we want to know how that happens.
So what type of impacts can they have on the Earth then?
Well, it's a range of effects that we feel. One which is probably quite familiar to people, even though you may not have seen it directly, you'll have seen it in books, and that's the northern and the southern lights.
The aurora.
Yeah, so that's a symptom of the sun-Earth connection. But then there are other things that have been reported over the recent years. So, for example, problems with spacecraft, damage that's been done to the electronics on board. They can have phantom commands induced in them. And we've even had satellites drop out of the sky because of successive effects from the sun.
They've actually dropped out of the sky.
Yeah, so you can get satellites losing altitude and starting to deorbit because these emissions from the sun can heat up the Earth's atmosphere and cause it to expand. So the satellites can find themselves in a denser region of the atmosphere, and in that case they experience more drag and they start to fall towards the Earth.
Well, it has a serious impact then.
It does, and the more we use technology, the more actually we're finding ways in which the sun affects us. So we have this very nice concept now of looking at changes in our near-Earth space environment and predicting something called space weather. So in the same way that you'd look at changes in the atmosphere, which are changes in our weather, we want to look further into space.
So will we have space weather forecasts on the end of the TV news?
I think that would be an interesting thing to have. So you could be looking at the sun, looking at the sun's emission, having a little forecast, then maybe there's some prediction about, well, you won't be able to watch such and such satellite TV channel because this one's going to be turned off because of this event coming from the sun. So it's an interesting thought.
Thinking of it being an International Heliophysical Year, how do you get a year?
Yeah, so scientists have to get up and make noises to make it happen, basically. And the UK were leaders in making this happen. So people got together and they wanted to do something to celebrate 50 years of space science and renew the focus on physics of the solar system, especially now. I mean, now is a very, very good time to be doing it because, as I mentioned, we have all these great missions that are looking at our solar system. I mean, great for looking at the sun and the Earth, but we have missions looking at other planets too and lots of other things happening in the solar system.
Well, that all sounds fantastic. We wish you the best of luck with the International Heliophysical Year and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Lucy Green there of the Mallard Space Science Laboratories. So that's the end of day 3 then. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.